All right. This is Roger Eardley Pryor. I'm at the Energy Co-op for an oral history with Damali Rhett. Today is July 13th, 2017. Damali, could you tell me how you spell your name?
So Damali is spelled D-A-M-A-L-I. And the history of my name is my father actually had the name before he even met my mother.
Ah.
He found the name in a Yoruba praise poem. And
in a what?
Yoruba. So Yoruba is a considered a people, like one of the Nigerian peoples.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of Yoruba, or there's kind of all those various kind of groups. Mm-hmm. And the name means beautiful vision. And so he knew he wanted a daughter, and he knew that that was going to be her name. Here is a fun fact of Philly history. There was a writer, she actually has since passed away, but she was based here, named Ellie Banks. And she wrote a book about a vampire huntress. And the vampire huntress's name was Damali.
Yes.
And this was years and years ago, and I actually emailed her. And she said I was the first Damali to reach out to her. And she was actually based in Philly, interestingly enough. So I actually need to go back and read those series, because the series were based here as their home base. And
in Philly?
She started off here, and then there were lots of traveling the world, and she wound up writing 13 books.
Wow.
And so it was very interesting in that particular series, how she wrote the books and what happened and how she worked through them. And so
I love it. When were you born?
I was born in 77.
Okay.
So I was born...
Where were you born?
October 17, 77 in Cleveland.
Oh, right on.
In Cleveland.
Did you spend most of your childhood in Cleveland?
I did not. And so my mom just graduated from college. And so my dad was already... I actually grew up in D.C. And so my dad was actually already in D.C. So kind of after the period of where they knew I was going to be fine, when I was 6 weeks old, I moved to D.C. And so I grew up in Washington.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about your parents? What are their names?
So my mom is Enid Doggett, and so she was born in Cleveland, is from Cleveland, still, but lives in D.C. now. So I've lived in D.C. for the last 40 years. Mm. My dad is Walter Rhett Jr., and he was actually born in Virginia, but mostly grew up in Virginia, a little bit in Virginia, but mostly in South Carolina. Mm. And so all of our family on his side is in about 25 miles outside of Charleston in a town called Somerville.
Okay.
And so...
Do you have siblings as well?
I do not. So I'm the only one.
Yeah. How did your mom and dad meet them?
My dad was at her TA.
Oh, yes.
In college. And so they met. My dad went to Ohio State, and my mom, being from Cleveland, she didn't go. She actually went to Ohio University.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's interesting is my dad and his brother both went to Ohio State. My mom went to Ohio University, and so I'm very much this Ohio State, you know, Ohio girl, like the whole Ohio State versus Michigan.
Yes.
Peace, I always got to go with my Buckeyes.
I grew up in Ohio, so you're speaking to the choir.
Yeah, so, and so like, and it's interesting too, because my mom has several cousins that went to Ohio State, but they met, when my mom was in college, and so my dad was getting a master's, and so was doing some work at Ohio University, and so they met there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
What was it that your dad was teaching and getting his MA in?
His MA is in urban studies.
Hmm.
And so his, I may get this wrong now, I believe his undergraduate's in Black history.
Awesome.
And so he actually is, now he kind of just writes for himself, but he's a specialist in Southern history, particularly around both Southern economics and kind of thinking through like Charleston. And at one point, Charleston Perlow rice was worth its weight in gold, literally, and, you know, kind of thinking through some of that. And then now writes, he's actually was named one of the New York Times did a feature on 19 commenters that comment on the New York Times. And he was one of those commenters out of like, I think like 30,000 active commenters.
Wow.
And so he like has this whole following and this whole piece. My mother actually went to school for journalism.
Hmm.
And so she wound up, she worked kind of as a journalist behind the scenes for a little bit when I was younger. So they were divorced when I was five, and mm-hmm. so they were both in D.C., so I was actually going back and forth between the two houses a lot and kind of a non-traditional arrangement. But grew up, you know, kind of working with, if you're familiar with the news radio station in D.C., the big one is TOP, mm-hmm. which still exists. And so my mom was working as a reporter for TOP. And so I used to go to the newsroom and desk, you know, when I was like a little kid and
wow.
would sleep under the desk and thought it was like the best thing ever. Mm-hmm. And so my mom wound up transitioning into public relations. Mm-hmm. So she's actually the co-op's public relations person now.
The co-op here.
The co-op here. Yeah. So, because I got to go with the best.
Of course.
And so just knowing her work and knowing what she's been able to do. And so she's moved into public relations. And so she did that recently, probably about 6 or 7 years ago, she decided to go on her own. But mm-hmm. prior to that, you know, held a number of, you know, director of communications roles and VP roles, working for both various organizations as well as, you know, traditional public relations firms
Yeah. Oh, it's odd. I love hearing the story of them coming together, too, in Ohio, of all places. So your dad, you mentioned your dad did undergrad in Black Studies, but by the late 70s, he's getting his master's. So he must have been one of the earliest generations of people taking those Black Studies courses.
He was, actually, and he was still very much, it's interesting in that, you know, you can imagine in the 70s going to Ohio State. So he was actually the first, in Somerville, he was actually the first Black graduate of his high school. And in Ohio State, I mean, you still had, I don't know the exact numbers, but it's very, very, very few. You know how big that campus
is? Yeah, huge. And so 50,000 more? Yeah.
You know, all of the very small number of Black students on that campus in the 70s with everything going on. And so doing that and having that, you know, the ability to do that, he definitely was one of the first. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
And what was growing up in Reagan era 1980s DC like?
Well, I tell people, it's interesting, I was watching a video on DC's food culture, because we have a particular, it's true, and somebody said there really are two Washingtons, right? There's the Washington that happens when you live there, and then there's the political Washington. And to the extent that you choose to be in one or the other is really up to you. Mm-hmm. Like, my parents, are obviously fairly active in the community and doing things. And I was 6, you know, working on Marion Barry's campaign, you know, stuffing envelopes. And so I was always kind of in both, but I think not having an understanding of, you know, Reagan and kind of what he was doing, you know, I didn't have to be involved in that. And mm-hmm. so it wasn't really until I actually did a congressional internship when I was in college. And I worked for Ron Dellums, he announced his retirement when I was doing the internship. And so this was 97, and he was a Black congressman from the Bay Area, had been in Congress 27 years-ish,
wow.
22 or 27 years. But this was during the whole when, like, Newt Gingrich was really, like, running the House.
Yes.
It was really, like, a big deal. And it was really interesting walking through various congressional offices or houses and seeing people and, like, literally just running into, like, Newt in the hallway, right? You know, because that's what would happen. In particular, also because Congressman Dellums had already been in office for so long, so he's very senior. He had been on a number of committees and that kind of whole process. So it's really interesting kind of understanding the inner workings and seeing that and seeing how, you know, people come in the breaks and getting that insider's view. And so that was really probably my first really insider's view into kind of the political Washington versus being in this whole, you know, and I grew up inside the city limits. So I went to D.C. public schools all my life, you know, grew up inside D.C. and seeing the difference in between the two. But even then, I think I really understood, you know, I fully understood the difference in traveling to different schools, the difference in my schools versus other schools even back then, because I went to one of the few schools in D.C. that had academic programs. And now, actually, one of the things I love is that they really made a much more concerted effort, particularly at the high school level, for high schools to really push and develop, you know, various programs and various, you know, bringing in outsiders and and making them the same level of kind of academic rigor across the schools. And so you have a school that when I grew up was notorious, where they just last year, all 100% of their senior class, you know, got college acceptance letters.
Wow.
Right. And so the difference in between when I grew up and seeing that, you know, is huge.
Yeah. Well, tell me about what was the name of the elementary schools that you went to in D.C.?
So I went to Hearst, which was a very small two-floor elementary school, 150 kids between K through 6.
Oh, that's intimate.
Very, very intimate. And it was actually, interestingly enough, on the campus behind Sidwell Friends. And so if you're familiar, Sidwell Friends is where, like, Chelsea Clinton went, where the Obama girls went.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's kind of like the default. It's a Quaker school, so Sidwell Friends. It's a Quaker school, but definitely very, you know, she, and lots of fancy folks there. And interestingly enough, didn't really have much interaction with Sidwell kids, because the way that their entrance is, their main entrance is on the other side of their campus versus our side. But very small school.
Is that something you remember noticing as a kid?
Not really. I noticed it more as an adult, because then I started driving past it, like, during my commute, and I was like, oh, this is probably why, because this is actually the front entrance and not that. And my school, though, I realized two things kind of later, but one is we had, because that area of D.C. has a lot of embassies, we had a ton of embassy kids, right? Our, like, international days would be, like, I still have, you know, off the chain.
Yeah. Right? Tell me about it. What are your memories?
We just had so many people, like, instead of just, you know, parents trying to put together a costume, you would have people just basically coming from the embassy with, like, full, you know, like, full food and, like, costume and just drinks and just, and so the level of people in my class was very, very mixed, both from a diversity standpoint, from a socioeconomic standpoint, and then from an international standpoint. And so growing up,
how lucky.
I realized my best friend was from Brazil and Portuguese, and I realized now her family was actually poor. And it's interesting because the house that she lived in now probably would go for like $1 million because it's been regentrified. But back then, that was not a good area of the city. And I didn't really, like, you know, you're the kid.
You don't
care
about
that.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I grew up with, like, just varying, you know, people from all over and knowing people from all over and seeing people from all over and just having these multitude of experiences. And then because we were so small, you know, like, we had a parent who was, and he wasn't even in my class. His kid wasn't in my class. His kid was like three classes ahead of us. But his dad was an archaeologist. And so every year we did like a dig out back.
Wow.
Right? Like who, you know, who does that?
Your school.
Through my school. Or we, like, a couple of times we went up to, like, you know, various places in the city and did like a little dig with like the shovels and the dust things to dust things off. And we never really found anything. But also we had one parent who was, he actually had a couple kids in the school. He was an architect. I mean, we built a model ski, like we drew plans and did it to scale and built, like, I built a model ski chalet in sixth grade.
Wow.
Right? Like,
I didn't even know what a ski chalet was.
We had pictures, yeah. We had options. Yeah. And I was like, I like this. It's slanted, you know, the traditional slanted. And I was like, I don't know this. And so thinking about, you know, those experiences and how, you know, the exposure, and I tell people now, one of my big things is just exposure to things. And so where I've done a lot of volunteering and talking and speaking to things, it's more really just to tell people that you have options, like that this worldview is not the only worldview.
Yeah, there's more to the world out there. Yeah.
There's way more to the world out there. And so I wound up, so kind of moving forward,
well, thinking back to having these kinds of experiences in elementary school and having these parents that are involved in this really cool work and involved in the community there, what was your vision for what you were going to go out and into the world and do as a child?
Well, I had none, right? As a kid, I had no idea what I wanted. it to be.
No.
And I think
it wasn't like, I want to grow up and be or do.
No, I think the thing that was probably consistent is I always loved books. Mm. And it's funny, I was talking to another woman and we're like, we shouldn't have been reading those books at 12.
Like what?
Like, a young kid should never read The Bluest Eye by, like, Toni Morrison. Or, like, we were reading, like, Greek mythology at, like, 12.
Do you remember the impact that especially The Bluest Eye or
it Toni? Didn't have, like, I didn't look at them with an adult. And I think that's one of the things is, you know, you see pictures and people talk about, like, this. It's as a kid, I never internalized that because I didn't understand. You don't always fully understand the depth of what you're reading. And so for you, it's just, you're just losing yourself in various worlds. And I mean, I would just read the encyclopedia, like, back when they had, you know, the kids' encyclopedias and just be, you know, have a good time with that.
Whoa.
And so
pre-internet traveling the world.
Pre-internet, pre, you know, what have you. And so I think, you know, from my standpoint, it just didn't. I think I'm still a reader, so I think it just makes you just start liking reading, right? And so, kind of moving forward, I think one of the things, two things, kind of set me on the path I am today. So I was accepted into Andover, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with the Phillips Academy Andover.
Yes.
And so they actually have a summer program called Math and Science for Minority Students, and they fly in for 3 summers. They go around the country and they do interviews and things like that, and they bring in a group. I don't know how many of us there were. I want to say there were probably about 30 or 40 of us from all around the country, and we go to Andover for 6 weeks in the summer, and we take math and science classes in Andover, and we're kind of part of like the Andover group. And so I wound up doing that. And it's funny, I met a woman who I met, who I'm going to college with. I actually just saw her last weekend, and I was like, this was 25 years ago. We met this summer.
Wow. Like, so what kind of stuff happened at the Andover?
So in Andover, it was just, I mean, it was so much fun. It was like a summer program. And I had been away from home before, but it was cool because I learned how to play spades, and you're seeing, like, different people from around the country. So you're asking questions. You're just seeing all kinds of different parts of, I would say, because it was so, it was underrepresented minority, so it was Black, Latino, and Native American. Mm. And that was definitely my first introduction to, like, Native American culture. Like, they would do, we would have, like, shows and, like, talent shows where people would show. And so, like, you know, my first hearing a true Native drum circle, right? So hearing that and seeing that and understanding that. And then at the same time, literally in the same show, we would have like a little mini gospel concert. Like, it's the when I think about how, like, we were like 14 and 15 doing these things, like, that people today just don't even experience, you know, like, of having going from like a gospel concert to a Native drum circle to like a full, you know, salsa dance, literally in the same show.
Wow. Yeah.
And so that was really cool. But I think the most kind of defining characteristic of it is in your third summer, because you go the summer after, you work backwards. So I went the summer before 12th grade, the summer before 11th, and the summer before 10th. But in your last year, you do college counseling. And so they make you sit down and think about college, not from this, I'm going to chase, like, I'm going to chase, you know, the best school. It's thinking about what size school do you want. And I knew I didn't want something super big, but I want something larger. You know, do you want to be city? Do you want to be rural? Like, asking these kind of, like, real introspective questions.
Yeah.
And then every Wednesday, we would go on different college tours. And so we went to, because it was in Massachusetts, so I was someplace close, so we went to Brown, went to RISD, we went to MIT, we went to Boston College, we went to
This was
Harvard.
All through the Andover program.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, gosh, what an awesome
And so
introduction
we,
to things.
Our longest trip, we wound up going to Dartmouth, which at the time was the most wired school in the country by Yahoo, for like 3 years in a row. So that's, you know, dating myself very much right there. And I thought I was going to major in engineering and go to med school.
Wow.
Yeah.
So wait, so before, when being a child and being like, I don't know, I love to read, but we'll see what's out there. And then the experiences at Andover to doing engineering.
Because I still love science. I still love, like, I loved biology. I loved chemistry. I loved physics. Well, not really love physics. Physics is always interesting. Like, but like chemistry and biology, loved it. Right. So I was like, well, I don't know what else to do. I don't know what else is out there. But, like, maybe I'll just go be a doctor, and that sounds cool. And engineering sounds really cool. And so Dartmouth kind of hit all my check boxes. And so I actually applied early decision because I said, I don't want to go anywhere else, but, and if I go there, great. And if I don't get in, then I still have time to apply to other schools.
Yeah.
So I wound up applying, wound up getting in.
Yes.
And so I also wanted to be someplace far enough away from my parents where they couldn't just pop up. Like, Dartmouth, you have to make a plan to go to Hanover. Like, you cannot just be like, we're driving to Hanover. Hey.
Why was it that you wanted that separation for yourself?
I think I just wanted to really be fully alone. And so I think part of being an only child is your parents just are like, my
very
child. And so I really wanted to be able to create some distance and some kind of process between, like, kind of be my own person.
Yeah.
And so went to Dartmouth, did not major in engineering. And so wound up realizing that while I like the pursuit and the study of, like, you know, math and science and those things, it wasn't going to be enough. Like, because there were other people going to med school, so I saw them, I talked to them, and it was like, the real question comes, like, do you want to sit through and fight through organic chemistry? And how much of that really do you really want to do? And are you really excited by that? And the answer to that was no.
Right. What did get you excited?
And so I got excited. I was actually wound up being a social psychology major.
Awesome.
And a theater minor. And so
please open up the doors to how that happened. That sounds
so
amazing.
I have always, as a kid at Hearst, we did a lot of, like, plays. We did a play a year. I mean, and we were doing, like, plays like Annie Get Your Gun and, like, Oliver Twist. Like, we were, like, think about these things. And we were doing, like...
This was at your high school.
This was at my elementary school.
Your elementary school.
My elementary school. And we were doing, like, we had Christmas programs and, like, you know, they included songs about Christmas and Kwanzaa and you know, Hanukkah and, like, you know, all these songs, right? And so... I'd always kind of been a little bit of a performer, and so not so much in high school, but in college, I joined the Black Underground Theater group, and I just liked plays, and so it wound up being basically to do a minor, I just needed like two more classes, and so I actually tell people if they're still in college to take an acting class, because that class, you know, my ability to present and how I'm comfortable and how I can stand on stage and how I can talk to people and how I know how to use my voice and all of those things of presence and place and all of that, you either get that through doing Toastmasters or you get that through acting or, like, other performance, right?
Yeah.
But with acting, you get the voice component as well. And so I actually wound up taking, like, all of the acting classes and then doing a lot of studying with, you know, some of the drama classes, and so did both black playwright. And so the highlight of that for me was August Wilson actually came and was a resident, like they call them Montgomery Fellows, but was a resident at Dartmouth for a semester. And so we actually did one of his plays, and so I was in one of his plays.
Wow.
And
what was that like with him being a part of all that?
It's scary, and he was also really an introvert, and so he was really quiet. And the how things come full circle, so I kind of deviate a little bit. So I did that play, it must have been fall 98, I believe. And I did that play. The gentleman who played my husband was actually on exchange term from Morehouse. He went on to become an actor. He's actually famous.
Whoa.
And he was actually on Broadway in an August Wilson play, Jitney. And so I went to see it, and I stayed after, and hadn't seen him in 20 years. But he remembered me.
Awesome. Who is this person?
Brandon Dearden. So he's been on, I guess, The Americans, because I don't have cable, so like a lot of some of the, I get some pop culture, but he's been on The Americans. Wow. He was on The Get Down. He was on, like, I was reading his whole history. And so he's been, like, a working, and that's, and he talked about that, right? So, but it's funny because that happened right after I saw, I went to see, so I am a donor to the New Museum, which actually reminds me, we should call them. And so I went to see Fences at a screening at the new African-American Museum of African-American Culture and History. And they had a panel discussion afterwards with, like, all of the actors in the movie. And then they had August Wilson's widow.
Wow.
And so I went up to her because it had really been almost 20 years. And she was saying how her daughter was 19. And at the time, her daughter was just a baby. Because we had this whole moment where he, August Wilson, was talking about how he was writing for his daughter. And so I was like, I don't know if you remember me, but I remember, because his wife was with him at the time.
Up in Dartmouth.
Up in Dartmouth. And I was like, so I was in Hanover, like, your time in Hanover, I was there. And she was like, I remember your face. And so we had a moment. And then after that, afterwards, I saw Brandon. So it's like this full circle completion of doing that. So I went to Dartmouth. And
oh, I love that story.
Yeah, it was so awesome. And it was... what was crazy about that story, too, is my cousin's actually a famous actor, and that's another story, but my, somehow it got to my cousin, and Brandon was like, oh, I'm such a fan of your cousin, and my cousin had seen him in Jitney, and was like, no, he's amazing, he carried the place, I sent, like, Brandon, like, a screenshot, I was like, this is from my cousin, like, he loves you, he's a fan of yours, But yeah, so I went to Dartmouth, I majored in psychology, I did theater, so we did a lot of different works. Black Underground Theater, we did everything from, like, I actually still write poetry, and so I started actually trying to perform it again, but then...
To perform your poetry?
I used to, I haven't performed it in college, and random since college, and randomly I was out at a jazz club and they had open word, and I did, I was like, all right, I'm going to do this, and it was horrible, but it was fine.
Horrible because it was crazy being on stage. Or
no, just it was like trying to do it, and I wasn't prepared, and I was trying to do it because it was like jazz musicians, so it's like trying to figure out what to read and have it right, and just it was fine. Because you just have to kind of break the ice as well, and so wound up doing that. All of my internships had been kind of after I decided I wasn't going to be a doctor, had been kind of communications based because that's kind of what I knew, just having done so much work. You know, both with my mother on campaigns, on various kind of events and things like that.
And your father's a writer, your mother's working in journalism and PR, I mean, that's
both my parents at various points have been writers, and my dad still is a writer. My mom, like, now writes press releases, which I guess counts. And so did work, went to work for a traditional PR firm.
Was this a different internship you're mentioning?
No, for after college. Oh, okay. So I graduated from college.
Well, can you, before we jump to graduating, can you tell me about how you made this transition from engineering and medicine? The theater thing I can understand, you were already working there, it was a passion. The major in psychology, what was the impetus
for that? I just took
psychology
and I thought it was really super interesting.
What was it about it that drew you in?
I think understanding people, and I think the first, like, really, because in Psych 101 you cover a little bit everything, and I think I became really fascinated with abnormal psychology and then also social psych, and so thinking about things like why do good people do bad things, like group psychology and group think. And I wound up, which actually wound up helping me, I wound up even taking a course on, like, business and psychology and organizational development and kind of thinking through what those things meant. And it was just always interesting to me. But I knew I never wanted to be a researcher.
Yeah.
Right?
Tell me a little bit about, I'm wondering two things. One is the relationship between your psychology classes and interests and how that plays out when you're taking on these characters as an actor. Was there a connection between this and I'm trying to understand people?
I would like to say yes, but not really.
Yeah?
Because it was, I think it just, since I never did enough, like, it was more, acting is more of a hobby, and was more of a hobby, than kind of this full-time, like, I'm going to embody characters and, like, do different things, mm-hmm. and, like, where I kind of need to always draw into that. And so even the characters, like, reading your own work is really just about voice, right? And it's trying to give credence to your voice and what you want. Reading and doing other people's work, a lot of times there's directors with visions, and so you're just really kind of embodying what they want, and you're putting your own self into it. But it's also kind of like you have an external force that kind of has a vision in mind, and you're working with other people, and so it's partially just relating to them as well. So mm-hmm. I like to say yes, but the answer is really no.
What about the ways that the taking these psychology classes and just the experience of college itself changed your sense of self about who you were and what you were about, what you were interested in?
I think being, you know, 18, 19, 20, I didn't really fully understand who I was and couldn't articulate it. And I think that's true of most people in college.
Yes.
And I think one of the things and the challenges, and you see it now, and I always say this when I go back and I talk to the Black students at Dartmouth, is Dartmouth and schools like it are the perfect intersection of class, privilege, race, gender, you know, all of these kinds of things. And so when you keep asking questions like, why do every 4 to 5 years we keep having a party that's always a problem? And it really is because you have groups of people who, I mean, Dartmouth actually, I was reading the alumni magazine this morning, and like, so out of the people from the 1%, Dartmouth actually is the highest percentage out of the IBs of people from the top 1%.
Wow.
Right? And so you think about what that means in terms of access, exposure, what I was talking about. And so you have people coming to Dartmouth who they've never met people who are poor, mm-hmm. right? They've never met people who, you know, I had classmates, I worked in the cafeteria, and I had classmates who would kind of be, I could tell they were embarrassed about seeing me serve them, mm-hmm. because I'm working, and for them, they don't have to think about work, right? It's like, it makes it very real to think about, like, things like money and process.
Yeah,
and
they've never had to struggle like that.
And they've never had to struggle, and nor have they even questioned it within themselves, right? And so you have places, like we actually did a play. It was an interactive play, and it was based on, you know, people talk about why all the Black kids sit together in a cafeteria. Mm-hmm. And so we did a play, we set it up in one of the theaters where we had all the white people come and sit down and say, what you don't notice is all the football players are sitting together, all the hockey players are sitting together, all the tryouts are sitting together. We just stand out because we look different. Mm-hmm. But it's not a segregation on, it's racist. Like, that's my only time to see that particular group of people, and everybody else in the cafeteria is doing it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, you know, when they thought about that, it's like, walk in and think about how many people you see that are the whole football team sitting together.
Yeah.
And then they started noticing that and thinking about that. But it's because we look different that we stand out to you, mm-hmm. versus you're not observing everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So after college, what was it that you did next? Where did you find yourself going?
So after college, I did communications. I went to New York.
That was, so after college was that internship in communications?
It was a full-time job.
Oh, okay. And
so
that
was full-time
in
job.
New York?
I had done various internships, different places. Like, I did a congressional internship. I had done an internship at a very small communications firm. Mm. I had done some things through, like, inroads and just kind of different things. And so I went to work for a traditional PR company based in New York. I was actually living in Jersey. Commuting back and forth, and so was in New York for a while. Realized in that job 6 months in that I hated it.
Well, what? Why?
It was just boring, and I was pitching to media, and I kind of didn't care, and I was just like, whatevs. Like, and it wasn't just that, actually, what I realized, because I was like, stay with your job, and I was like, well, do I want my boss's job? And so because then I knew I had something to look forward to, right?
Yeah.
I was like, all right, you know, I could put up with this if I really wanted her job, but I didn't want her job.
Yeah.
And at that point,
well, why are you in it?
Why am I in it?
Yeah.
So I wound up quitting after 6 months and going to work for a online brokerage firm, which was then Daytech Online, which doesn't exist anymore. And they were, this was in 2000, so this was right before the market hit, like the tech boom, hit its peak. So wound up like, you know, making more money. As what was really interesting about that was I was working the overnight shift, and I was working this crazy shift.
What were you doing there?
I was doing customer service. And so it was 40 people on the team, three women. Wow. So it was really, that was really, really learned a lot about men. And it was like, I don't want to say stereotypical Staten Island, Brooklyn. Like, I know people hated the Jersey Shore and was like, they all suck. And like, why are they promoting people? But I was like, I met a lot of people like that.
From the TV show that were your
co-workers. That were my co-workers. Like, especially the men, because like Italian men don't leave their houses. So they were all like 25, 26, making good money, living in their mama's basement. Like,
wow.
Because it's just, that's culturally just what, and they all went to the gym, they all tanned, they all went down to the shore. I was like, you may not like it, but.
There's that reputation of the tech industry of just being such a patriarchal space.
It was, like, the only time, so very few things offend me, and I actually had to report this guy who was technically, is a gray area because I was licensed and he wasn't, so he couldn't technically legally be my boss because he was supposed to have a license above me and he still didn't have a license. So I was like, he can't be my boss. But I was like, he's looking at naked Latina women on the computer behind me, and like, it's not even offensive that he's doing it. It's more so that he doesn't recognize that this is a problem, right? Like, he should at least be on a, like, this was really before smartphones. So it was like, dude, you can't do that.
That's not okay. Yeah.
Like, you just can't do that at work. And so that was kind of the only thing. But you just, I mean, it just, you just become, you know, and so it was interesting there. That's kind of where I actually found a memo. And that's where I realized I've always been a problem solver. So, like, 3 months into the job, I wrote, like, a 16-point memo about how we can improve, like, areas we can improve customer service and the team and this, that, and the other. And wrote all these suggestions. And was going to send it to the senior VP of like customer service. And like, I asked my boss to sign the memo and he like totally freaked out. He was like, you can't send this. And I was like, dude, what's he going to do, fire me?
Right, for helping, for trying to make things better.
But, so what they wound up doing was they wound up having me work, because I was actually either always number one or number two for like being rep, like on the rep. So I had a lot of time, especially like 4 o'clock in the morning is totally dead. So they wound up basically giving me, like having me work with like the customer experience team is kind of like an outlet and channel. And then because I had passed the test that that guy didn't, I don't know if he ever passed it technically. They had me like lead classes and stuff on the test because I passed it with like 93%. It's a series 7. Like I passed with like 93%. So they were like, can you help the rest of the team pass it and stuff like that? And so did that for a while and the market started declining. And so
this was around just after 2000.
This was 2000. So the market peaked in March of 2000 and then it hit its decline after that. And so around 2001, I'd been in the job for more than a year, and I was like, well, I don't want to do customer service anymore. And like, I was trying to actually switch to this team I had been supporting, but they had a hiring freeze, and they were like, well, we can't hire you. And I was like, well, why am I kind of doing all this extra work, but I'm not really getting paid for it? And it's like, cool work, but at some point, like, we got to figure something out.
Yeah.
And so it actually wound up happening, and this is one of the things, like, I still am very much a believer in God, and I, like, one weekend, it was just, like, I was just tired of her. I was like, I'm gonna quit, and my mother was like, don't quit, like, just wait, and that was, like, on a Friday, and, like, Monday, they announced packages, and they were like,
wow.
So I was like, okay, now I can get paid to quit, yay. and so got paid to quit.
That one feels like it's meant to be, huh?
It's always meant to be, so got paid to quit. So quit, I obviously took a package, wound up joining a temp company, and I actually temped at a company that was a startup, and they do receivables, So I was like kind of like a little bit of admin researcher, kind of like probably program assistant was probably, because they didn't really need an admin because they kind of had an admin person, like people to sponsor. The company actually still exists. They actually still do receivables. But they were like heavy finance guys. And so temped there, which is actually really cool. But, and they were like, you can stay, we'll make you permanent. And I was like, I don't really want to stay. I don't really want to do finance.
Yeah.
It's super, make sure everybody gets me. We're good on time.
What was it that you didn't like about it?
It's super detailed. It's like, I'm a strategist. I'm not like an engaging, like be way down in the weeds kind of person. Mm-hmm. And doing finance and building models, like my database manager, she loves that, right? She loves like digging into the weeds. Like it drives me insane. And so just doing that, I just knew it just wasn't like they were cool. And had I stayed, I probably could have made a ton of money, you know, now that I don't think they've gone public, but just, you know, it would have been like literally they had started like 2 months before I came on, right?
Wow.
And so wound up joining the Bank of New York, which wanted somebody who asked a lot of questions in their stock transfer department. So they actually wanted somebody who asked a lot of questions but didn't have an accounting background, right? And I knew stocks because of my licenses and things like that. So I wound up joining them, and they were doing like very traditional financial management. So like back office, accounting, you know, they were still processing journal entries on paper that you had to send to like a central location to get everything done.
Wow.
And so I was doing like journal entries and financial management and like helping with billing and all these kind of interesting things. And eventually I got bored there too. And so what they wound up doing, so two things that are really cool about that. I loved my teammates, right? We would throw, and we all loved each other. Like we would literally throw, I worked with a woman, an Italian woman from Staten Island, was probably in her 50s, worked with a man who, another Italian man, definitely in his 50s, worked with a woman who was then 81, an Italian woman who worked, she had worked, Bank of New York had acquired a company, so she worked for the same company for the last 47 years.
Wow.
From Italy, you know, or her family's from Italy, worked with like a German guy who was like probably in his early 60s, he was gonna retire. We would just, and this other woman who was from Trinidad.
How did this, right? This international mix, just, like your elementary
New York,
school?
And we, and I was young, like 20, how old it was, like to like 24, 25. I mean, we would go out and like, I would get smashed, and we would all, and, but they would, like, they loved me, and so they would, like, make sure I got home in a cab, and, like, the whole thing, right? We would just go, I mean, we would throw parties where we would be, like, I would bake, because I still bake. They would, like, the other one would bring in, like, chicken parm or lasagna. The men always forgot their assignment, so we started giving them stuff that they could pick up downstairs in the store downstairs, like here, sodas and fruit. Like that's what you
go downstairs and get those.
I mean, it would literally just be we haven't had a party for a while. Let's have one tomorrow. And so we all loved each other.
Aww.
But from the actual work I was doing, it was not engaging under any circumstances.
That like, seems to be a common theme that you dive into something, once you figure it out, there's just no challenge there, and so it's time to move on.
Well, so I actually stayed because they can figure out things for me to do. So I wound up doing this, they wound up putting me on this committee that was being run by the CEO, that was called Client First, where every department was tasked with forming a committee that looked at, you know, improvements and cost savings and things like that to help productivity, right? So that was kind of really run where we collected suggestions from everybody in our department. And then we implemented them. Like, we kind of weighed them against resources and time, and we implemented them. And the reason why is my boss's boss, who at one point was running a division for BNY, and I should send him a note, I haven't reached out to him in a while, but he was, like, senior vice president of, like, back-end processing. He wound up kind of going through the bank. Knew, like, he was, like, you're bored, go do this, right? And knew I had the time. Ways to do this. So I did that. So that was super cool. It kind of kept me engaged and interesting. And then at one point I thought I was going to go to law school, right? Because so friends do matter. So the number one like thing that Dartmouth graduates do is go to law school, kind of not immediately after, but over some point in time. So a bunch of my friends were applying to law school, so I was like, well, I should apply to law school. I was like, I'll do securities law. It'll be super cool and super fun. And so I went to, I did the whole thing. I took the LSAT. I applied to law schools. But one of the things I did, which I actually do tell and I'll talk about my clients, is I did a lot of like soul searching. So I did a lot of work around out talking to people in law school, not in law school, current practicing lawyers, former practicing lawyers, people who just, you know, kind of had various career paths and really trying to figure out, okay, do I really want to be a lawyer? And wound up kind of coming to the answer, no. Like, this is, like, law school would get me to the job prior to the job I would want. It wouldn't get me to the job I would want. And I said, okay, really, what are you interested in? So we went back to kind of the psychology. And, you know, by then I was kind of reading, like, industrial organizational psych journals, like, just random articles here and there. And so I said,
what was it about? Why? Why were you reading?
Because I recognized that Bank of New York, like, for example, at the time, I don't know how they are now, but they didn't have a program for me, right? And they didn't have, like, so I got to take, because my boss didn't want me to take accounting and finance, so they paid for me to take, like, accounting and finance courses. But there was no program that they could throw me in. There was no leadership development program. There was no, like, oh, we're going to move you. We recognize you're talented, so we're just going to assign, like, an executive to you and move you through the bank and kind of keep you at the bank, right? And somebody, you know, pretty senior, quite frankly, told me, was like, you'd be better off quitting and then coming back and moving that way than you would to stay in the bank. And so I was fascinated by this kind of lack of, again, I was already a problem solver. And the reason I was on a committee was because I was a problem solver. And so my boss, that mentor at the time, was getting an executive MBA from Columbia. And so just talking to him about like the projects he was working on, I was like, oh, this sounds really cool. And so I started thinking about doing like a master's in IO psych. And I was like, well, you kind of have the psych background. I was looking at the classes. It's like, what you really need is the business background. And you really need to kind of understand business. And a little bit, like I said, taking a couple of, you know, econ and accounting. And so I kind of understood my debits and credits. But so I was like, okay. And so I started looking into business schools. And that's how I wound up going into you know, schools still do, but they had, you know, went to info sessions at, like, NYU and, like, different schools and different programs. And
knew you wanted to stay in New York, though.
I did not.
Oh.
I knew I did not.
Oh, you did not.
I did not. I went to NYU because it was there, because it was convenient.
Yeah. Okay, can you tell me, so the career path is fascinating, but the place is also interesting. I mean, New York is a unique animal. What was life like there for you?
So I think at the time, I think in New York, like, there's a point of where you start to block out people because you just have to, because there's so many people and so much coming at you and so much stimulation. So it's super fun, but I also think at the time, you know, if I compare my sense of self now compared to my sense of self then, probably is better. I was not the person I am now then, right? Probably would have just caused havoc all over the city.
Why? What do you mean by that?
Just because I think being sure of yourself and being in New York, like, it creates different opportunities and it creates, like, I remember I was standing, like, taking a train somewhere, and, like, and a man came up to me. He was like, you should be in a music video. And I was like, what? And it actually turned out that he actually was somebody who could have made that happen. But I was just like, you know, I was not, I'm definitely an ambivert, but I was way shyer. So it's just like, what are you talking about? Like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, go away. And so just thinking about, whereas now I'd be like, sure, let's sign up. We go in there today. Like, yeah. Do I need a passport? Like, what's going on? Although I wouldn't be in music videos today. They're horrible. But so I think just being in a place, sense of self, you know, like, I had my group of friends. I joined a historically black sorority. And so the difference in that is, like, you're always a member for life. So I was doing a lot of volunteering and work with my sorority and meeting, you know, women there through that, which was a lot of fun and, like, very worthwhile. And just so, but it wasn't, like, it was expensive and it still just felt like a lot. And so at the time I was just like, I don't want to kind of live here. And I was like, it'd be too much to raise kids here, kind of my process. And my thinking now, now that I'm more than, you know, 13 years from that time frame, is a little bit different. Like, now when I go back to New York, like, it's much more manageable. I don't know if I would go back. It would take a lot of money for me to go back, just given, again, how expensive it is and how, you know, if you're not getting set up there, it's very hard to be set up there. But I still have a lot of friends and, you know,
so
there.
And it is the major city in America, especially in the Northeast Coast. And you grew up in D.C., but you went to school in this very remote place. So can you tell me a little bit about what city versus kind of a more rural or even suburban kind of feel? What is it about either that you liked or didn't?
I like both, right? So I think one of the things, I am a Libra, so I think having that balance. And I like both. Like, I still love New Hampshire for its peace and its beauty. Like, when you go, it's you're there, and you can just be, and you can just exist, and you can just exist on a field with mountains and stars and just breeze, and there's nothing else, and there's no sound, and there's, you know, there's a sense of having other people's energies and having that process, and you don't have to kind of have that.
Did you have experiences like that? I mean, Rock Creek Park is such a huge part of D.C.'s.
It is, but it's not quite the same because you don't get that unfiltered light. Like, it's still, you still have light pollution, and you still kind of have, and you can't really just go to Rock Creek Park at night.
Yeah.
It just be out. Like, Dartmouth is such, not so much now, which is interesting, but Dartmouth, especially back then, I mean, you could be in the green at like 1 o'clock in the morning and it's quiet and it's dark and it's, you know, and that's just on the green. Like, you're not even, you know, off campus at that point. And so, you can't really do that at night, and it's very hard because you still have to kind of drive and kind of be there. But I think cities are, you know, like, I'll always want to live in a city because I like the ability to go back and forth, but I like the ability to do things like go to Target and, like, you know, like, I have a car, but I like the ability to just go somewhere, have drinks, and, like, you know, get a variety of experiences, which you don't necessarily get as much being in the middle of, you know, in the Upper Valley, right? Yeah. I mean, you definitely have much more experience than you have. I've been to more rural places, and so I think they're, you know, they've developed a community, and even when I go back, like, there's always something new and always something different. And so I enjoy my time being up there, and I enjoy my time engaging in people in that sense, in that way, but I also enjoy being back in the city. And so, so from that standpoint, I think it's, yeah, I think it's great.
So,
sorry, one second. Yeah, please. I just need to make sure before he leaves, he gets...
Well, let's just put a pause here. It seems like a good point to take a break. All right. So take me to the point where you're thinking of MBAs and you're in New York that somehow brings you to Philadelphia.
So the shorter version of that is I decided to get go to business school. And I knew I wanted to go to business school, and at the time I thought I was going to be an organizational development consultant. And so being a consultant kind of would get me to that kind of mix of psychology. I would have my business background. I would still be problem solving because I obviously at that point loved to problem solve and go in and fix things. And so wound up applying to various business schools, got in, but looked at where I would have the kind of best professional and personal experience, and that wound up being Tuck. So I wound up going back to Dartmouth. Even though I really wanted to go to someplace else, but I wound up going back to Dartmouth. And so went to Tuck, loved it, still love it, still am actively involved and actually starting, you know, restarting an organization for diverse alumni at Tuck, so working on that.
Very cool.
And so went to Tuck, did organizational development consulting for the summer, and so said I really liked consulting, but I didn't really want to have this focus on organizational development. I really wanted to focus on the broader, because I kept having all these questions about different parts of the business and kind of organization development. You're focused on kind of one part. And so wound up saying, okay, I knew I definitely wanted to be a consultant. And so wound up graduating from Tuck and joining Deloitte.
And why did you know you wanted to do consulting?
Because I love the problem solving, right? I love asking all the questions. I love digging in and finding all the questions, which was my expectation when I went in. And I talked to people in consulting and kind of said, why are you in consulting? And what do you do? And And they, you know, I love that they would say, like, no 2 days are the same, and, you know, you kind of go into different companies. And so, obviously, as you picked up on, I, like, I need stimulation, and so I don't want to be bored. And so with consulting, there's no 2 days the same. Even if you're doing the same project, it is never the same at different clients because of different locations, different politics, all these kinds of different things. But one of the things that, so tech has, they call it something different now, but it's essentially you do a global consulting project for a real company. Mm-hmm. And so you spend 3 weeks on site somewhere internationally.
Wow.
And my project, we spent 3 weeks in Puerto Rico, which technically is the U.S., but
yeah.
Our project was looking at a market entry decision in the Caribbean. And so as part of that, we had to look at electricity use across the region in Central America. And I was fascinated by how differences in prices, differences in generation, differences like Costa Rica, I don't know what they're paying now, but it's still probably 90%+ hydro, mm-hmm. versus Jamaica, which is a huge, still today is running mostly off diesel generators, right? Huh. And so you're thinking about the difference in that. So I said, you know what, I'm really interested in energy. So I went to Deloitte. The partner that recruited me happened to be an energy partner.
Uh-huh.
And so I did my first project in Washington, D.C. at Pepco, uh-huh. Which is their regional utility.
Did you, I want to go back to this, the market entry opportunity that you had this internship in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. Was that the first real entrance you had to the world of energy?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first experience. What was the actual project? What was the
project was, should the company enter the Caribbean market?
In terms of energy production?
In terms of energy. So they were a liquid propane company, and so could they enter with either propane tanks or what have you? Because most of their market came from people, cold weather, and so places where people were using propane for heating,
mm-hmm.
where obviously in the Caribbean there's nobody using it for heating.
Right.
And so what are the other opportunities either for emergency electricity generation or industrial use? And mm-hmm. so we were looking at it from that perspective.
Had you thought about energy in your own life growing up in New York or how you get around, anything like that? Hadn't really been a factor, no?
I had no idea.
Huh.
Right, no idea. Just, I knew I turned on the lights and they were there.
Yeah.
And I knew, well, at the time I didn't really have a car. I mean, I drove, but like, I had a car in high school for like a few months, mm-hmm. but yeah, didn't think about it, right? So there's gas and there's electricity.
So where was the Deloitte, when you got hired by them, where was that based out of?
I went back to D.C. because mm-hmm. I said in D.C., I had lived there since really before college, because I spent like a couple of internships there, but I was mostly off, mm-hmm. right? And then I was in New York and New Jersey, and so went back to D.C. and because it didn't matter because you were going to be on the road all the time anyway. And Deloitte actually has their main energy offices are Houston and D.C., or Houston McLean, because it's technically McLean. And so it wound up being a nice fit, right, because I could be in McLean, still working energy, kind of being surrounded by energy partners.
Mm-hmm.
And so wound up going back there and did kind of traditional on-the-ground consulting for 5 years. So
when did you start in the Deloitte position?
2006.
Okay.
Yeah, so right after I graduated from school. Had that summer off and then started right after Labor Day,
mm.
which is pretty typical of most firms. Some firms now are doing staggering starts, so people want to take off longer, and it allows them to kind of incorporate people a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so did that, you know, loved it, but just got a little bit tired of being on the road. And so was given the opportunity to work internally for them for 2 years. And, you know, said, hey, this is great. You know, I was working in your national power and utilities office, supporting a bunch of different partners, doing a bunch of different cool things, which are still relevant. Like, I was having a meeting. I wrote, led the team that wrote 2 white papers at EV. And yesterday I was meeting with some folks about EV. And so the things we were thinking about 5 years ago are
EV
now
electric vehicles. Yeah.
Are now like kind of come, people are asking these questions now, and like, we were asking those questions 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so wound up leaving Deloitte for a variety of different reasons. And so part of was, I was at the time definitely in an abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. And so it was just kind of leaving that, even though I liked what I did at Deloitte, I kind of just needed to take a total break
from
everything. And so, you know, loved the team, loved the work I was doing, but just was like, all right, we're out. So when I'm joining IBM, going back to the traditional consulting, they were trying to rebuild their kind of utilities practice. And so I was like, I'll go back on the road. I haven't been on the road for a while. It's fine. IBM is a really interesting company.
Where was home? Where
still
was
DC.
Still home.
Because you're on the road. It doesn't matter. And IBM has no office culture. Like Deloitte, you actually usually come in on Fridays. There's trainings, there's lunches, there's happy hours, there's meet this person, meet that person. IBM has none of that. So the only time I actually even went into my IBM office was because there was a women's event that IBM was sponsoring that was not IBM, just they happened to sponsor, and it was held at the office. So I was like, oh, I'll just work from the office, and then I don't have to fight to come into the city at rush hour. I'll already just be there. And even then, like, trying to do that, like, Deloitte was very easy. Like, I could go online, make bookings, book a desk in any Deloitte office anywhere in the world. Huh. Super easy. IBM, like, I showed up, like, nothing worked. It was a mess. But they're not set up for that model, which is interesting because now they're saying you have to live within, like, 50 miles of an IBM office. Like, they just made that announcement. And people are just saying it's just a back end to kind of get people to be fired, to quit without them having to do layoffs.
Interesting.
So worked for IBM, which was...
Still doing the energy consulting.
Mm-hmm. And so loved my team.
How were the projects different?
IBM is not as strategic, so I wound up leading a team of 19 developers. Doing very technical stuff, which I'm not a technical person. I learned a lot. Like I am smart and I'm quick pick up on things. So I want to be able to sit in meetings with like enterprise architects and technical architects and questioning them and offering my input. But that's not what I want to do. Mm-hmm. Nor was it something that is in my strong suit, mm-hmm. So despite as I look on my screen, I'm teaching myself HTML5 because I'm building a website, but also we're redeveloping our website. So I just want to know what questions to ask. Mm-hmm. So it's actually useful to be able to think about, like, I don't want to build websites. I just want to know what questions to ask. But it was a good experience. It's come in very useful and handy sense because just, again, understanding technical things, understanding how, you know, code and things are developed. But their projects were, I think the challenge is, and there have been several articles in this, and actually I was meeting with a woman who were like, why hasn't Jimmy been fired? Because they lost money every year for like the last 5 years, every quarter. And in some of the things they're trying to do, the market's growing, right? And the average tenure of the executive team is something like 30 plus years, right? So if you take that, like IBM used to make things. And so when you make things, some of the processes and procedures and things actually matter. Mm-hmm. But when you don't make things and you have a professional services team that by definition needs to be flexible, you need to have systems that are flexible. And Deloitte, you know, obviously had the systems, mm-hmm. and IBM didn't. And so it's just interesting to see the difference between the two.
I've heard Steve Jobs talk about the difference between a marketing company and a company that produces and makes things, and how the atrophy of the marketing people, when they get into higher executive positions, the company doesn't grow the way that a builder company does.
But this company needs the opposite, right? They need strategists. They mm-hmm. need people who are not focused on, you know, when IBM was making servers, taking the synth out of the production chain actually does matter, right? It doesn't matter when you're billing that penny to the client. It doesn't matter, right? And if that penny saves me as a consultant, if I spend $20 more or $50 more to take a non-connecting flight, the value of my time and the potential for all of these downstream things is worth way more than that $50, mm. right? Like taking a non-connecting flight that costs $50 more is way more valuable to both you, the client, my well-being, yeah. me as a company. So I wound up leaving IBM just because I absolutely actually just hated it. I couldn't stand it. And there was some politics going on where it just was not a place where I wanted to be or grow a career. Mm-hmm. And so wound up leaving there, joining a renewable energy company that was based in Bethesda.
Why renewable energy?
Because it was still energy, and it was kind of a newly created role. And so I was able to kind of use and stay in my industry. And so at that point, when I left IBM, before I kind of made the decision, when I was job hunting, I really made a decision. Because at that point, it was like, either you got to stay in energy, or you kind of got to, like, make a switch now. Mm-hmm. And I really said at that point, you know, I have this experience. There's one, not a lot of people of color, not a lot of women. My experience is worth money on the open market. Let's do that.
Run with it.
Right? Mm-hmm. So worked with the a renewable energy company based in Bethesda, who's the world's largest producer of industrial pellets. Mm-hmm. And so it was a newly created role. And so they were really looking at how to enter new markets, how to approach things differently. So it's kind of like an internal consulting role.
What are internal or industrial pellets?
So they're pellets. You can actually use wood waste and create a pellet from them. Basically, like if you've seen like a cat pine or like a gerbil pellet, mm-hmm. like an animal pellet, you can actually use that to burn instead of coal. And you get way less of the bad emissions. Even taking the entire life cycle of like trucking and shipping. And you could actually even in the US potentially co-fire with coal and save again. You get less of the SOX, you get less of the NOx, you get less of those bad things, and you're using a, you know, renewable product because it's really wood that's coming from like forest thinnings and like the leftovers from lumber yards. I mean, pretty much anything that's wood you can use. Mm-hmm. You can technically use agricultural waste too, but the agricultural waste, I remember I was at a conference when I was working there talking to like an agri professor from like Texas A&M, not UT, Austin, Texas A&M, to have this whole conversation. But agri waste kind of produces different, doesn't produce worse emissions, it does different things within the boiler. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to manage that a little bit differently. But
why in Bethesda would this company exist?
It existed in Bethesda because the founders went to UVA, and the company was actually founded in Richmond. So they were Richmond first. And then they were like, well, we can't really get talent, and kind of just like as we grow the company, we need to move somewhere. And so either the CEO lived in Bethesda or just like they wanted to be outside of DC. Mm-hmm. And so that's why they wound up being in Bethesda.
Yeah.
I forgot the exact reason, but they were like, at some point they had two companies, and so they sold one and then went with this one.
Gotcha.
And so they were like, we need to grow, we're going to need to hire staff, we're going to need to hire, you know, environmentalists and mm-hmm. all of these kind of things that DC has plenty of people or environmentalists and sustainability and all those folks. And so,
So you worked for them, and then that was your entry point into renewables.
That was, well, yes and no. So I had done some renewables and alternative for big, large utilities, right? And so when I was in energy, I did a little bit of everything because as a consultant, you always have to kind of be a little bit of everything, right? So you are, so I did oil and gas, I did traditional power and generation, I did a little bit of alternatives. Most of the companies, and I did renewables for like large utilities, right? Mm-hmm. So like thinking through like some analysis papers on, you know, what is the renewable market gonna look like, because most utilities are generally in a wait and see. And so at the time, particularly with wind and solar, they were nowhere near as inexpensive as they are now. Mm-hmm. So they were kind of like, well, we need some. But this was also, you know, with really states, really before, most states haven't, but really, they had really aggressive renewable portfolio standards and kind of those things as
well.
Gotcha.
How did you end up coming to Philadelphia and the energy co-op?
So from that standpoint, so I went there. That wound up not working out for several different reasons. I consulted on my own just for like through projects with friends for probably about 10 months. And so I was still looking for a job, but I was being very, very strategic about it. And so I said, I want to stay in energy. I wanted to kind of have somewhere go to my experience and not do consulting.
You were done with the consulting at that point.
I was done with the consulting. Just being back on the road, and just like, it's fun. I mean, I love the work. Like, I love the work I do, but there's kind of, at that point, I'm just like, and so I saw the job and I posted it. So I was living in DC and then they called me back. And here's the interesting thing. So it's right around my birthday, I had walking pneumonia. And
wait, say it again.
I had walking pneumonia.
Oh.
So I was like, they called me in for an interview and I had to cancel because I was like, I literally am like
a zombie. Yeah, and I
like on antibiotics and on codeine.
Oh.
Right? Because the doctor frankly told me, she was like, there's really, like, we'll give you the antibiotics, but really you just need to sleep. So here's like cough syrup with codeine because you don't want to wake up like hacking. So they rescheduled. And I was like the last person they interviewed, like on the very last day. I actually still had a touch of it, so like pulled myself together, like took the train up here, took the train back, and like collapsed for like another 2 days. But they hired me.
So did you know anything about what the co-op was?
I looked it up. I had done a lot of research. In being in DC, which is deregulated, I was very, very familiar with choice and generation. And so what was interesting to me was, one, that this was a nonprofit. And so really understanding kind of how they operate in the space as a co-op. And DC does not have nearly as many co-ops as Philly does, mm-hmm. right?
Can you tell me maybe briefly explain what the Energy Co-op is?
So the Energy Co-op is unique in that we are a retail energy cooperative. And so we are nonprofit and member-owned. So our members own, you know, a piece of us, which means if should we ever dissolve, at some point, you know, the members would get whatever's left over from our liabilities and sales of our assets. Most electric, so this is a little bit different. There are about 2,000 plus electric cooperatives in the U.S., but the majority of them, I've only been able to find about half a dozen that are actually retail. So the majority of them are actually serving their customers, our members, in the exact same way that PECO serves us, right? Through generation or through transmission, distribution, and purchasing power on behalf of their members, but not at a wholesale price, right? We are actually purchasing clean power wholesale and then basically reselling it to our members, right? Mm-hmm. So that in the choice, they can get a choice to support clean power.
I see. And because Pennsylvania is one of the few states that you can make that choice of where you're getting energy, even through PECO as a provider. Mm-hmm. So they would go through PECO, choose the energy co-op as their provider, and purchase through PECO, purchase what energy co-op offers?
No. So they actually can, go to us, come to us, and we would sign up. So we're their generation. And so I actually, at the meeting, you know, did a kind of mini, why do I have to get my bill through PECO? Because even if you join us, you still got to get your bill through PECO. Mm-hmm. And the short version of that is PECO owns, very, very simplistically, the last mile to your house, right? So that electricity has to flow and has to move to your house to actually power your house. Mm-hmm. PECO owns that last mile. And for the reasons I get into in that presentation, that will always be a monopoly. What we are is a generation supplier. So you are allowed to buy, it's just like the same thing with the gas in your car. You own your car, you have to maintain it. Think of PECO as like you as the car, you have to maintain it, you have to change your oil, you have to do all of that. You can buy your gas from anywhere, mm-hmm. right? It's the same thing, is that you can buy, we are a gas station, you know, same on the corner that you want, and you want to buy this gas station because we're brighter, we're lighter, we're cleaner, you know, not, we're green, but it's that same kind of concept. And so you can sign up directly through us and we'll let PECO know, but your bill will still come through PECO and we'll have a line item on it that says charges from the energy co-op.
Gotcha. So when you came to work here, and that was around what time? Like year?
That was November. Of last year.
Oh, okay.
So I've only been here, I guess, almost 8 months now. And so 7 months.
Yeah, that's when you moved to Philadelphia.
So actually, no. So I actually was, some wonderful friends live at 20th and Walnut and have an extra room. And so I was actually going back and forth, so coming here on the week during the week, staying with them, and then going back to DC on the weekends. And so trying to figure out where I was going to live and get a feel for the city. And so doing, like, after work, apartment hunting. I wound up moving to a house, but I actually formally moved in January.
Okay.
This year. So found a place in Brewerytown, rented a lovely two-bedroom house, and formally moved in January.
Awesome.
So
tell me about your experience of being in Philadelphia. What's the vibe for the city for you?
So for me, it's just, I think it's been different. Like, I recognize and start to understand how Philadelphia is definitely much more less transient than like a New York or a DC, right? Even from DC, you know, I think recognizing, like, I meet people who are not from DC all the time. And I think in Philly, one of the things I notice is people who are from here either stay here or leave and come back. Mm-hmm. And so I think that creates a really good sense of community and people knowing people and being, knowing who everybody is and kind of where everybody's from and what everybody's doing and kind of where everybody is. Mm-hmm. And for us, being an organization that's been around since 1979, really means that we're going to have roots here and we're going to be here. And so it hasn't been like a super adjustment. I also think there's kind of like an East Coast aesthetic to cities. And so, you know, for me, the greatest thing, which is awesome, is I can actually just take a bus to work. Like, I don't have to drive. And I can take a bus, which, if traffic has been reasonable, is 30 minutes, you know, pretty much from my door to door. And so, you know, just getting used to, the only thing I think that for me is 76, which is, I think, a problem for everybody, because, like, on
Interstate
the other
76?
Side, yeah, it's the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and I used to have to drive to Cleveland, and most of that's on the Turnpike, and it's just not a fun drive. And so at some point you get past 76 and you're like, oh, 76 is being 76 right now, right? Where it's like mountain and cliff, and you're like, and you know, the next, I remember one year I drove and they were working on all the like service stations. It was like 110 miles before you can get gas. Like, get gas now. And like the line was like, you know, everybody getting gas. But, you know, for the most part, my adjustment has been relatively seamless. Hi, are you leaving?
I'm leaving.
Okay, I'll see you over there.
Okay. Thanks.
It's his wife.
Oh, awesome.
Who's doing the event. Because I have friends here, and so just, you know, meeting new people and like groups and kind of getting out. I think the hardest thing has actually been, like, for whatever reason, on weekends, like, either I've had like pre-events that have already been planned for a long time in DC or New York, so I feel like I'm not getting enough time, you know, in either being here on the weekends. So like my goal is to try to be here more weekends. Which I think in the fall, like, all of the events and conferences and things like that that I've been going to are all actually in Philly, so I'm like, it's kind of neat.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Right on.
So.
I'd love to make the transition to thinking about the ideas of the future. Mm-hmm. Would it be better to schedule another time to allow us to move into that?
I was going to say, we probably should at this point.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Well, let me turn this off and we can figure out a time to come back and revisit our visioning.
Chatting about... Mm-hmm.